The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to this recording of the American College of Osteopathic Internists Internal Medicine Board Review Course. The course was held in Baltimore at the Marriott Waterfront Hotel on May 8th through 12th, 2019. The course featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of importance to the internist preparing for initial certification or for recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Parathyroid disease, calcium metabolism, and osteoporosis is presented by Dr. Jack Snitzer.
And we're going to talk about something that's, we're going to start from easy and then go to hard, I think, as the endocrinology lecture goes on. But endocrine is pretty easy, as you all know from taking your, or if you have taken your board test. Everybody gets all the endocrine questions right. Maybe not. We'll talk about parathyroid, calcium metabolism, and osteoporosis. And I have no disclosures, no commitments to other pharmaceutical companies or research. Oh, and please feel free to call or email if you have any questions or problems. People do that all the time. If you, not every community, as you know, have endocrinologists. So I know I am, and John's probably open for any email requests or questions you have. So we'll talk about the parathyroid glands. There was a big article in the New England Journal just last week on hypoparathyroidism. If you haven't read it, get it out, read it. Very interesting article. It doesn't say dramatically new things, but it does mention that if you have hypocalcemia due to hypoparathyroidism, it's a distinctly unusual type of thing. So you have to really look into it, work it up, make sure it's not anything bizarre other than a primary hypopara. But that's sort of just a FYI, very good article. There's four parathyroid glands in the neck usually. There could be less, there could be, there's usually not more, but there could be. And they could be in various locations, but they're usually next to or inside the parathyroid gland. They could be located various portions of the neck, so sometimes it's very difficult to find them either radiologically or with surgical procedures. The parathyroid glands, parathyroid hormone, I should say, regulates serum ionized calcium very strictly via GI absorption, bone turnover, osteoclastic function, in other words, renal excretion, and 25 vitamin D to 125 dihydroxy vitamin D, which is calcitriol, conversion. And if you are ever ordering these blood tests, hopefully your hospital, electronic records, or whatever you have there will try to help you not default to the wrong blood test. If you're ordering a 25 vitamin D, make sure it's 25, not 125 hydroxy vitamin D. The normal ranges are pretty similar in some labs, and sometimes you order the wrong test accidentally because it might be first on the list. So just make sure you order the right 25 vitamin D. We'll talk about 25 vitamin D in a minute or longer. Vitamin D is formed in the sun from sunlight. It's converted to 25 hydroxy vitamin D in the liver, converted to 125 dihydroxy vitamin D calcitriol in the kidneys, and regulates absorption of calcium from the diet. And remember, calcium is mostly bound to albumin. It's as you get older, you make less and less of the enzyme that that makes vitamin D in the skin. So even older people, patients often say, oh, I stopped my vitamin D supplementation in the summer months. There's no reason to stop it. And as you get older, that's even more so. Just keep taking the vitamin D if you need it all year round to get in a good habit, if nothing else. The inactive form of, and they say inactive form. It used to be called inactive, but they think it has some effects possibly even on the DNA. But the inactive form of vitamin D is 25-hydroxy vitamin D as far as absorbing calcium. That's why they say it's inactive. So you have two forms, basically. D2 is ergocalciferol synthesized by plants, and D3 is cholecalciferol synthesized in the skin when exposed to ultraviolet B rays from sunlight or whatever. Foods might be fortified with either of the vitamin Ds. D3 might be a better form of supplementation. That sort of goes back and forth, but we think D3 is probably a better form. The goal for vitamin D, and this is in flux, they might change this goal, and they change their nomenclature. What's vitamin D insufficiency, vitamin D deficiency? We don't know really what to do because we don't know who has worse outcomes when they have low vitamin D and how low that is to have worse outcomes. But the goal, again, is 30 or higher for the vitamin D. Generally, you want it below 80. 100 or higher might start getting to the toxic level, where toxicity is defined as hypercalcemia from too much vitamin D. No convincing data that this helps bone density or other issues. However, it might depend on whether the patient is significantly vitamin D deficient and the dose. A lot of studies, the Women's Health Initiative, et cetera, they show, often they show either no benefit or you get benefit when you have higher doses, like 3, 4, 5,000 units a day. So make sure, first of all, that the vitamin D is replaced in normal range. But the studies, even within normal range, they show that these higher levels of vitamin D might be what's good for the bone. Other things that vitamin D might help, there's all kinds of things, cancer, autoimmune conditions, but nobody's ever proven that. That's more hearsay than anything else. Replacement regimens include vitamin D3, 1,000 to 5,000 units daily, or vitamin D2, 50,000 units every 1 to 2 weeks. But remember, vitamin D generally stays in the system quite long. So if you give someone too much vitamin D, such as 50,000 units, and they inadvertently take it every day and become toxic and they get hypercalcemia, it might take weeks for them to really get over that, and they might need supportive care. So as I said, you can become vitamin D toxic since vitamin D is a fat-soluble vitamin. Doses over 7,000 units daily might cause toxicity and defined as high calcium. Levels over 100, as I said, might cause hypercalcemia. Vitamin D goal is 30 to probably 80. It says 100 there, but it's probably closer to 80. Now we'll talk about primary hyperparathyroidism. If you practice medicine, you'll see cases of primary hyperparathyroidism all the time. And you want to make sure it is primary hyperparathyroidism because if you have somebody with a low PTH and a high calcium, as we'll talk about later, you got to think of bad things. So primary hyperparathyroidism is very common. About 1 out of 100 people over the age of 60, 65 will get or have primary hyperparathyroidism. A slowly increasing calcium level. If the calcium level was 9 yesterday and it's 20 today, it's not primary hyperpara probably, even if it got severely dehydrated. But it's a slowly over years increase in calcium level, but it can acutely become quite high if a person gets dehydrated. Generally, it's a benign solitary adenoma, could be more than one adenoma. Hyperplasia is less common, might be associated with MEN. When you have hyperplasia, you always think of MEN syndromes. Also consider MEN in a younger individual who has primary hyperpara. Parathyroid malignancy is uncommon and often associated with a higher and a fairly rapidly rising calcium. I've seen a couple, or two or three or four cases of parathyroid cancer, and they have pretty high calciums. They could be 15, when 2 months ago it was pretty normal, the calcium. Or it could be 20. I've had a calcium of 20, 21, like I was joking about a minute ago. But you can see those levels in parathyroid cancer or in infarcted parathyroid glands. If you infarct a parathyroid gland, sometimes it spills all its parathyroid hormone into the bloodstream, and you get these awfully high calcium levels urgently and quickly. Ectopic PTH production is rare and generally has a very high, acutely very high calcium level. Had one case a couple years ago. The patient unfortunately died. It was a uterine cancer that made PTH ectopically. Very, very rare, but as a matter of fact, the person even had parathyroid exploration to try to find out what was going on because it looked like primary hyperpara that had to be treated urgently. Couldn't find anything, and it turned out, and then I think necropsy, it was a uterine cancer. So the classic triad is bones, groans, psychic moans for primary hyperparathyroidism. Renal calculi, abdominal pain, osteoporotic fractures, and subperiosteal resorption, which is of the distal clavicles and the phalanges. Findings of severe hypercalcemia might include, and some of these are I think are important to remember, anorexia, nausea, polyuria, peptic ulcer disease, weakness, and shortened QT interval. So subperiosteal resorption is the left slide. You can just see little radiolucent areas on the phalanges, the distal phalanges. And a brown tumor is the black arrow. The brown tumor is a fibrous tissue, woven bone, and supporting vasculature, but no matrix. Not really important to know what a brown tumor is. It's not per se, it's not a tumor in any bad sense of the word of a tumor. They may be rarely associated with ectopic parathyroid adenomas and not really tumors. The diagnosis of primary hyperparathyroidism, nine times out of 10, it's pretty classic, pretty easy to detect. But you have an elevated intact parathyroid hormone and an elevated or high normal calcium. So in other words, if you have a high normal, if you have any of these that are sort of top normal, or one is top normal and the other's not suppressed, like if you have a high top normal calcium, or let's say a high calcium, but the PTH is not low, then the PTH is inappropriately normal, so that could indicate primary hyperpara. Ionized calcium is a better test if done reliably by your lab. I often have people whose total calciums, even when you correct it for the albumin, the total calcium is sort of top normal, but the ionized calcium is frankly elevated. Elevated calcium, as I mentioned, elevated calcium with inappropriately normal PTH, or elevated or top normal, or you often have an elevated or top normal 24-hour urine calcium with all 24-hour urine samples, include a creatinine and hopefully try to get a volume too. If you don't get a urine creatinine, a 24-hour urine creatinine at the same time, you don't know if the patient collected a good sample or not. So if the calcium's low, they might have missed a few collections. Radiologic testing, as with any endocrine disorder, don't go looking for diseases until you biochemically prove them or have a suspicion. So radiologic, and you don't have to do radiologic testing if you're not going to do anything about it. If a patient's not a candidate or not going to have surgery, why do a few $1,000 radiologic test in order to do nothing with it? Sestamibi parathyroid scan might miss a parathyroid adenoma, the false negative rate, in other words, 25% of the time. So a negative parathyroid scan, and our hospital does it with SPECT also, but it misses it a lot. So have a high index of suspicion. They might miss hyperplasia, and they might miss a malignant gland. It might miss one or two parathyroid glands. It might say you have one parathyroid adenoma, and you actually have two. So you need an experienced parathyroid surgeon, because that happens not infrequently, where they find a second abnormality when they were looking for just one because of the scan. Neck ultrasound should be considered. It depends on your surgeon and a bunch of other things. I used to always get a neck ultrasound. Now we do the SPECT, so I don't necessarily always get an ultrasound anymore. Generally, it's due to a solitary benign parathyroid adenoma. Not uncommon is more than one benign adenoma. Less common is parathyroid hyperplasia. Uncommon is parathyroid cancer. Very rare is ectopic PTH. So I wanted to reinforce that by putting a second slide for that. The vitamin D level in primary hyperparathyroidism is usually low due to increased conversion of by PTH of 25-hydroxyvitamin D into 125-dihydroxyvitamin D. So it pushes the process to the right, and you burn up your 25 vitamin D while you're making 125 vitamin D out of it. It's important to replace the vitamin D when you have primary hyperpara. I know the patients are a little bit nervous. My calcium's high, doc. You told me that I shouldn't be taking. You told me that I shouldn't be taking anything. Well, it's probably not correct. You want to replace the vitamin D, not with a huge amount, if they're vitamin D deficient, with 600 to 1,000 units daily of vitamin D3, since the PTH might actually be higher due to a secondary cause of vitamin D deficiency stimulating parathyroid hormone production. So you want to give them enough vitamin D to reduce any secondary hyperparathyroidism from vitamin D deficiency, but not give them any more than they actually need to raise their, that would raise their calcium level. So you got to be careful on that. And also, if they don't have surgery, you got to be careful also If you don't want them to, you don't want to raise, you bump their 24-hour urine calcium excretion too much, because then you increase the risk of kidney stones. So treatment is also fairly fairly straightforward. 9 times out of 10, the treatment's either observation, and I'll go over some indications for this, or Sensipar, which is cinacalcet, or surgical neck exploration by an experienced parathyroid surgeon who can fix the problem in one surgery. If surgery is done, watch for postoperative hypocalcemia, very common for a few days, hungry bone syndrome, in other words. Intraoperative PT, your surgical hospital has to have an intraoperative PTH assay. If it's not, send the patient somewhere else. So an intraoperative PTH should reduce by 50% to indicate operative cure. So while they're on the table, the surgeon sends out a PTH level, and the PTH level should drop by 50%. And that's very indicative of a total cure. Treat any bone loss, which we'll talk about later in this series, if they have osteopenia or osteoporosis, do something about it. There was a recent study in the past year that showed that if somebody has osteoporosis and they have primary hyperpara, treating the primary hyperpara does more to improve the bone density than the bone density medications. So it's something to consider. Can be used for, Sensipar, cinacalcet, can be used for medical management of a patient with primary hyperpara who is not a candidate for surgery or who refuses surgery. There's a lot of debate whether making the number look prettier really does much for the patient. But I've seen cases where people seem to feel better and do better, and they're happier, the numbers in the euboxic range. 30 milligrams of Sensipar titrated up as needed. Might be better at lowering the calcium than actually reducing the PTH. I've seen both happen. Indications for surgical treatment of primary hyperpara, and these depends where you're looking. This Canadian standards have a little bit different than the European, and American standards are sort of a mishmash of both. But the serum calcium greater than 1 milligram per deciliter over the normal range, the top normal range for calcium, would be one indication. Creatinine clearance calculated reduced to greater than 60. Bone mineral density worse than minus 2.5, standard deviations of the spine, hip, or radius, or presence of a fragility fracture. In other words, osteoporosis. And we'll talk later that if you have a fragility fracture, it doesn't matter what your bone density is, you have osteoporosis. Patient younger than 50 years of age, that's another indication for surgery, or calcium stones. Other possible reasons to consider surgery in a non-compliant patient: bone aches that might be related to hyperparathyroidism. That's something that's not recognized out there, but a lot of patients do have bone aches that they write off as arthritis, and when they have parathyroid surgery, they might actually feel a little bit better. I had one patient who fairly rapidly, over the course of a few months, couldn't walk anymore because of heel pain. Said, no way is that related to your parathyroid. You have primary hyperpara. No way is that related. And this patient was in her 70s. She had parathyroid surgery that was curative, and the next day she was walking fine. So you never know. And sometimes some organizations say a 24-hour urine calcium excretion greater than 400 milligrams daily. However, that's generally not used as an indication. You do have to get a 24-hour urine for calcium. The reason is, and you have to ask your patient if they have family history of high calcium, which they may or may not know. Because mild hypercalcemia with a normal or slightly high PTH, which mimics primary hyperpara, can also be FHH, which is familial hypocalciuric hypercalcemia. No treatment is necessary. It's a benign disease. Nothing needs to be done for this. 24-hour urine calcium will be low in this situation, and assuming it's not low for other reasons, like being on HCTZ, then they might have FHH, but FHH is pretty rare. Secondary hyperparathyroidism, you see this a lot. Causes of secondary hyperpara: low calcium, low phosphorus, chronic renal failure, which can be called renal osteodystrophy with osteitis fibrosa cystica. Vitamin D deficiency, which can cause osteomalacia in adults, or it's called rickets in children. Now, if you have a hypercalcemia, high calcium level with a low PTH, the causes of this are many, and they're also can be terrible. Vitamin D excess. We're in this vitamin D mania in the country for the past 15 years or so, and I love vitamin D. I think I gave the first lecture to the ACOI annual convention when vitamin D first was coming to our knowledge base. And so I have a long history with using vitamin D and getting it, but I think we got to be careful on it for reasons I'll talk about in a bit. But vitamin D excess, somebody says 50,000 units of vitamin D every 2 weeks is good. Taking it daily would be better. Wow, you know, that's not good for most people. That will cause hypercalcemia, and the PTH will appropriately be low. Malignancy is a big thing, metastatic to bone or PTH-related. Granulomatous disease, increased formation of 125-hydroxyvitamin D is what's the cause. TB, sarcoid, histoplasma, et cetera. I see patients fairly regularly with this. I've diagnosed many cases in the past few years of sarcoidosis from this. Thyrotoxicosis, you will see this. It will cause transient hypercalcemia until it's treated. Immobilization, adrenal insufficiency, which can cause high or low calcium. Thiazide diuretics, it lowers the urinary excretion of calcium. It improves resorption of calcium by the kidneys. Milk alkali syndrome. I've seen a couple cases, not classically from people taking Tums and tons of milk, but some people taking calcium supplementation, actually bicarb for their renal tubular acidosis. They were taking bunch of bicarb and a bunch of calcium, and they had milk alkali syndrome. But the classic is lots of Tums and lots of milk. Hypercalcemic emergency treatment, saline diuresis, loop diuretics, zoledronic acid, which is one of my favorites, 4 milligrams IV can keep the calcium down for up to 6 weeks. It's very long standing. Zoledronic acid, by the way, can also treat Paget's disease of the bone. And one treatment often is all it takes. But zoledronic acid has to be reduced probably by the pharmacist in your institution for renal function. Pimidronate, which is our hospital uses pimidronate a lot. I guess we have a level of comfort, but I usually say, let's try zoledronic acid. But pimidronate is not affected by, or does not have to be really adjusted much for the kidneys. But pimidronate only keeps the calcium down for 2-3 weeks. Glucocorticoids obviously can work very well quickly. And calcitonin, which we still use in the hospital. I have some. I had a partner a couple years ago that used calcitonin a lot, and a lot of people do use it. I'm not a big fan of it because it doesn't really last long. It doesn't do anything in the long run. What are you going to do when the person gets home? So I don't think I've ever used calcitonin in the hospital, or at least within for 20 years. Causes of hypocalcemia, low calcium. If they have a low PTH level, then they probably have primary hypoparathyroidism. Surgical is the most common. Idiopathic or autoimmune are much less common. A few case reports of hypopara being identified caused by low magnesium, hypomagnesemia, due to a proton pump inhibitor. I look for this all the time, haven't found it, but it's something you really have to watch for. I think it's a real thing. Treatment is oral calcitriol and calcium. PTH is a new option. There's a real good PTH subcutaneous pen you can use now. It's expensive. You have to titrate it to their calcium regimen. You can also use, besides oral calcitriol, you can also use regular 50,000 units of vitamin D. But these are people who need ridiculous amounts because they don't turn vitamin, if they have hypopara, they don't convert vitamin 25 vitamin D into 125 vitamin D very well. So you might have to give them 50,000 or 100,000 units a day of vitamin D, of vitamin D to 50,000 units each gel cap. So with high, if the low calcium is also associated with a high PTH level, then that's something we see probably a little bit more commonly. Adrenal insufficiency, calcium or vitamin D deficiency, in other words, nutritional. Celiac disease. About 28 years ago, I wrote a paper on celiac disease doing this as a cause of patient who had what looked like arthritis pain, and they actually had basically, you know, rickets. This patient had rickets due to low vitamin D, due to undiagnosed celiac disease. And gastric bypass surgery, especially the old version of gastric bypass surgery, the malabsorptive gastric bypass. Renal failure is a common reason, and total lack of sun exposure. This is MEN. I would just pack it away somewhere and remember, just say you heard about it and remember it a little bit. Type 1 is Wormer syndrome, parathyroid hyperplasia, pancreatic tumor, pituitary adenoma, the three Ps. And type 2A is Sippel syndrome, medullary thyroid cancer, PHEO, and parathyroid hyperplasia. Now we'll talk about osteoporosis, and we'll try to get through this quickly. The timer's not running here, but I assume I have still 30 minutes left because it says I do. Probably not. Osteoporosis, now the DEXA, osteopenia is DEXA is still the gold standard for diagnosing osteoporosis or osteopenia. T-score between -1 and -2.5 is osteopenia. Osteoporosis is -2.5 or worse. In young individuals, use a Z-score if they're under 50 years of age most of the time. There's something called the FRAX. We don't treat people based on numbers anymore from the bone density machine. We treat them based on clinical history, their judgment on what they want to do, and also on their risk of breaking a bone in the next 10 years. So don't just look at a bone density and say your bone density is bad, you need treatment, because again, if somebody's young, their bone density could be bad. They might not need treatment because they're not going to break a bone in 10 years. The FRAX is a 10-year probability of major osteoporotic fracture and hip fracture. Osteoporosis can be present and diagnosed regardless of bone density if a person has a fragility fracture. The T-score is a standard deviation from the mean bone loss of young adults. I know I had to answer that question on one of my tests, but it's used for interpretation of 50 years or older. Z-score is for is comparing to age-matched controls. FRAX calculation tool is meant to be used with patients not on anti-resorptive or anabolic treatment, considered to be high risk if a person has a greater than 20% 10-year risk of major osteoporotic fracture or greater than 3% 10-year risk of hip fracture. It was developed to try to prevent over-treatment of young people and under-treatment of older people, because older people can have pretty good bones and still be at high risk because of quality of the bone. DEXA studies don't measure quality of the bone. So you can calculate FRAX by going to FRAX website, just Google FRAX. And I'll sort of skip these. The point of these is that if you have a 45-year-old Caucasian female with no risk factors and she has like osteopenia, a T-score of -2.3, her FRAX risk is very low. If you add things like smoking and other issues like that, family history, or if a parent broke a hip, then the FRAX risk goes significantly up. Like here's a 72-year-old with the same osteopenia as a 45-year-old, but she has a 3.6% 10-year risk of hip fracture, much higher even though her bone density was the same as a 45-year-old. So the bone density caveats, don't just trust the bone density reading because it could say osteopenia and it's osteoporosis, because if there's significant degenerative changes of the spine, these can cause false elevation of the BMD in this region. So the lumbar spine bone density will look good. The number will be pretty, but it's false because arthritis makes the number look better. So the reader of the bone density should say the spine is falsely elevating the bone density, or leave out the spine. Or you can pick two vertebrae if they don't have arthritis. You can, if L2 and L3 have a lot of arthritis, don't use them to analyze. The reader should do that. But you know, we know that that doesn't happen, so you really have to be your own advocate here. So if the spine bone density is better than the hips, think that that might be false. Screening in women starting at 65 or younger, men at 70 or younger, if risk factors, I should say, for both of them. Adults with a fragility fracture, adults with a disease or condition associated with low bone mass or bone loss, adults taking medications with bone loss associated with. Anyone being considered for treatment, kind of vague. Anyone being treated to monitor treatment effect. Anyone not being treated in whom bone loss would initiate treatment. Or if they've had a height loss of greater than 1.5 inches lifetime. It's a spine, hips, spine and hips, and if they have hyperpara, you order the wrist. Everybody else, you generally order the spine and hips, but hyperpara, you add the wrist to it. Hyperpara preferentially worsens cortical bones. When to repeat a bone density study, no good recommendations. Medicare pays for it every 2 years. You can sometimes get it paid for earlier if something big's going on, but you really have to document it and fight with them. The ACP says to repeat in 5 years or longer in many cases. Endocrine organizations are hotly disputing this. Risk factors, low body weight, prior fracture, high risk medication use, disease or condition associated with bone loss, including anti-seizure medicines, late menarche or early menopause. So just go over some of that there. Peak bone mass is about 25 years in a woman and 30 years in a man. Calcium recommendations under 50 is 1,000 milligrams daily. 51 plus is 1,200 milligrams daily. We prefer that you get your calcium from food. There was a study showing that calcium might increase the risk of heart disease, but that was probably false. There were two studies that showed that about 8 years ago, 10 years ago. It was probably false. The studies were probably not correct. But we still say minimize the oral calcium and try to get it, most of your calcium in dietary form. Men under 70, 1,000 milligrams daily, 71 or higher, 1,200 milligrams daily. Vitamin D recommendations, and again, who knows for sure. Under 50 is 400 to 800 units a day, and 51 plus years old is 80 to 1,000 units a day. Resistance and weight-bearing exercises are targeting various bone areas to treat osteoporosis. Avoid smoking, limit alcohol to 2 or 3 or less drinks. Adequate dietary and calcium and vitamin D intake. Fall avoidance is really important. Here are the medications I'll go through quickly. Alendronate, which used to be called Fosamax once a week, 70 milligrams. These are all poorly absorbed, about 1% of bisphosphonates, and these are bisphosphonates which inhibit osteoclastic resorption. Only about 1% is absorbed after you take it by mouth. So if you do anything wrong, it's not even working. It's not even getting into your system. Residronate, same thing. It's 35 milligrams weekly or 150 milligrams monthly. Ebandronate, 150 milligrams monthly or IV every 3 months. Zoledronic acid, reclass, which is 5 milligrams yearly. Bisphosphonates orally can cause esophageal erosions, loss of efficacy after 5 to 8 years. Atypical femur fractures after probably 8 years, so we don't use bisphosphonates for more than 8 years, although the risk is low. Osteonecrosis of the jaw is more commonly associated with high-dose IV therapy. Dentists, as you know, are very afraid of osteonecrosis of the jaw, but the problem is the actual incidence of ONJ is not known. So we don't know how much bisphosphonates increase it because we don't know how much it happens. It's actually not a terribly uncommon thing from what the literature says, but if you get it from a bisphosphonate, nobody wants to do that. Then there's Prolia, estrogen, which is no longer recommended unless they need estrogen for something else. Evista, calcitonin, no longer recommended. It's very weak, and there's some issues that there might be associations with cancer. Calcium, don't know if it works, but people should be repleted with that. Vitamin D, same type of thing. Vitamin D probably helps, as I mentioned before. Prolia is 60 milligrams sub-Q every 6 months. It's an anti-resorptive. The same side effects as bisphosphonates, but no esophageal things. Make sure the vitamin D level is corrected, because you can get severe hypocalcemia, especially in renal insufficiency patients or renal failure patients. Prolia is really the only drug we can use in severely renal insufficient patients, but you got to correct the vitamin D, very important, and the calcium, or else they can become super hypocalcemic from even one dose of Prolia. Forteo is one of two anabolics. We have another one called Timlose that just came out fairly recently. It's a partial parathyroid hormone analog. It's a shot given with a pen once a day for 2 years. It's osteoblastic. It can only be used for 2 years. The company probably doesn't want to use it longer because in laboratory animals, it's been associated with osteosarcoma. Okay, secondary causes, hypogonadism, vitamin D deficiency, parathyroid disease, myeloma, malnutrition, elevated prolactin, which lowers the gonadal hormones, urinary calcium, hyperexcretion. Don't forget that. Some people just have bad bones because they urinate out too much calcium. So if the 24-hour urine calcium is high, sometimes HCTZ is the treatment. You lower their, you make them hold on to more calcium. Malabsorption, as I mentioned, is really important, celiac disease. cortisol excess, prolonged bed rest, certain medications, seizure medicines, anti-estrogens, excessive thyroxine replacement or hyperthyroidism,